I think most people are here now, so I can start today's talk on Tuesday morning. First 3 days of this retreat, the Saturday, Sunday and Monday, I still have some more coming. Okay, you haven't missed anything, I'm just starting the introduction. The first 3 days of this meditation retreat, I've encouraged people just to really take it easy, to let things be. And that is done deliberately, not just to be kind to you, but because I know that that's the way that with rest and relaxation, we're doing less. So not only are we improving our physical health, we're also learning how to do some more letting go. It's almost a trick the first 3 days to ask you to let go for the sake of just relaxation, but it's also an important part of the meditation practice. As I've been focusing on for the talks so far, to learn how to just allow things to be content, to be happy to be here, to open the door of your heart to this moment, to accept any demons who come into your palace, to welcome them with kindness. Because the path of letting go is just the path of peace, and it is the essence of meditation. Sometimes I've told jokes that if anybody I teach them meditation on the breath. If they can't manage to learn meditation on the breath, then instead I teach them another method of meditation called Anapanasati. And if they can't do Anapanasati, then I teach them metta meditation. So if they can't do metta meditation, then I teach them loving kindness. If I can't do loving kindness, I teach them letting go. So the purpose of the underlying theme of this joke is that all these meditation techniques are exactly the same. They all depend, rely upon a person. So just allowing their controller just to disappear so that the whole mind can become very still. However, it's such a difficult thing to do, to let go, to go on this path which the Buddha trod of like abandoning, relinquishing, letting go and making peace. So because of that, we always have to get many, many skillful means, you know, so we can learn just what it's like to let go. And when we learn what it's like to let go and what the results are of letting things be, they're so peaceful, they're so wonderful, that all of the ideas and the conceptions of what letting go is all disappear as you realize it's so peaceful, it's so wonderful, it's so delightful. But once you've achieved so the stages of letting go, you realize that that was exactly what craving and desire was promising all along. You crave, you desire, you work, you will, to get to these stages which you only get when you stop craving, when you stop desiring, when you really let go. You find this is where fulfillment lies. And also you understand why so many people in the world never get that fulfillment, that happiness and peace. Even though they aspire for it, they're going in the wrong direction. So this is actually trying to encourage everybody to at least get some experience of what the stages of letting go are. So you understand what we're talking about, not through theory, but through experience. And once you have some experience of letting things go, letting things be, the peace, the stillness, the bliss, then you can go back and say, how did that happen? And understand the causes of letting things be. Because the problem with human beings, though, is one of the big obstacles to letting things go and letting things be. The more you let things go, the more you let things be, you find the more that you disappear. And for many people, that's such a strange and terrifying prospect for them to disappear. But even though you have nothing to do, we do things, we control things, we think, just to say we're still here. And I was talking last night about being rebellious. The only reason why people are rebellious is they say, look, I exist, I'm still here. It's a self-affirmation, or a trying to affirm yourself by doing things differently. Which is where all control and all will come from. You know, just to say, I am here, I am me, you know, I can do things differently, I can choose. And so a lot of times, to be able to let things go fully, sometimes we do need a lot of appreciation of what it means to have no self. You know, just to allow the ego and the me and the mine to actually to vanish. So sometimes a little bit of faith and understanding in those Buddha's teachings of emptiness, the emptiness of a self, are very helpful. But still, just the faith is not enough. We have to have experience. And so there are these wonderful skillful means. You know, skillful means of, you know, what the Buddha taught, what people like Ajahn Chah taught. I remember looking at that picture which somebody gave me last night, looking at that this morning. I remember the last time, it was about last January, when I went over to Thailand for the Ajahn Chah's Memorial Day, you know, the anniversary of when he died. So we always have a big meeting on that day. I try and go as often as I can, but I can't go every year because people complain in Perth, they never see me. The last year I went, and you see all your old mates, all the other senior monks, you know, who go there. And some of those other senior monks, because, you know, we know each other, we're best of friends, they started teasing me. Ajahn Brahm, you're putting on weight. And I said, but I'm fit. And he said, no, you're not. I said, right. So we were staying at this monastery, Wat Nanat Chart, which is about 8 kilometers from Ajahn Chah's monastery. We all stay there because there's not enough accommodation in the main monastery. And all the Westerners, we hang out there together and have lots of chats and jokes, and, you know, we have our friendship and fellowship, because, you know, we've known each other for over 30 years. We're just like old school friends. And if you think that these monks are serious, when all you guys get out of the way, some of the things we talk about, I wouldn't want to have recorded. So we're just friends. We're humans. So anyway, so I think Ajahn Yada especially, no Ajahn Yada though, he'd say, you're too fat. And I said, you're too lazy. And so we're just teasing each other and said, okay, I'm going to walk the 8 kilometres. And Ajahn Yada, because he's got a bad foot, he couldn't walk anyway. And he thought, we're never going to hear the last of this, we're never going to hear the last of it, and he's not going to hear the last of it. So I walked over the 8 kilometres just to prove how fit I was. But, and everyone else got in the car. But on the way, because I was with the junior monks, we were walking, and on the way, this was actually one of the main arms rounds which Ajahn Chah used to go on. And so as I was walking, all these old memories came back about all the things which Ajahn Chah would tell you and teach you, you know, on these arms rounds. Because it wasn't just going for arms, it was a chance to be with your teacher. And I remember this one place, I remember the place exactly, and all the memory came back. He picked up a stick on the ground, and he said, Brahma Wangsa, is this heavy? And before I could answer, he threw it away. He threw it into the ditch. And he said, it's only heavy when you keep holding it. And those were the great teachings of these great masters. So easy to understand. It wasn't just some very, very deep Dharma which you had to sort of, you know, learn the Abhidharma and all these sutras and try to understand. It was very simple but very profound. The stick's only heavy when you hold it. And that's what we mean about letting go. Life is only heavy. The past is heavy. The future is a big concern. The credit crunch is only a worry when you hold it. When you throw it away and you let it go, it's no problem anymore. So he was teaching us how to let things go, but also that why is it we keep on picking up sticks and keep holding them all the time? We throw one away, we tend to pick up another. So, you know, here today, you know, you've thrown away so much to actually to come here. You know, your job, your family duties, and your house, and all these worries you have back there in the world. You've thrown all that stick away, and what do? You go and pick up other sticks. I want jhana. No, I don't want to sort of be sleepy. I want this and that. And that's a problem. And sometimes you wonder, why do we do that? Why do we keep on picking up and attaching and worrying about things which are basically none of our business? Again, so being in a monastery, sometimes when people talk about what goes on in the world, and you see all these like movies and TV shows and these adventure world places and like bungee jumping and going on these rides, you know, like a death drop or something. And sometimes I just wonder, why do people actually pay money to be tortured? Because that's what these things are. You know, death drops and bungee jumping. That's what they used to do in the Vietnam War, apparently, just try and throw people out of aircraft just to, you know, to make them confess to what was happening. But we actually, we volunteer to do that. And sometimes we want to be stimulated. anything to worry about, anything to desire. And it reminded me that somebody told me of this curse, and I thought this was the worst curse you could ever put on somebody. And it came from probably the Middle East. It was probably from the Sufi tradition, I reckon. But it's very, very Buddhist. The worst curse you can ever give on anybody is, may you get everything you want as soon as you want it. And if you really think about that, may you get everything you want as soon as you want it. And why is that a curse? Because that will drive you crazy. Because a lot of times, that, you know, if we get what we want as soon as we want it, there's no struggle, there's no strife, and a lot of times what we're really attached to is not the achieving of things, we're attached to the struggle to get them. That's actually what we really like to do, to struggle, to strive, to work hard. The goal is not important, really, it's the struggle to get it, that's what we're attached to. You think about that, because as soon as, you know, you see these people actually, they win the lottery, and they get more money they can spend, and it's well known, as soon as you win a lottery, the next week you buy another ticket. Everybody does that. It's crazy. What do you want to do that for? So it's always the case that it's the struggle, the striving, which is what we're attached to. And why is that? It is because that is us. We are doing something. And when we do something, we are. Which is a real great difficulty of this meditation. Because when I'm telling you not to struggle, not to strive, the thing which you're attached to most of all in your life, you're achieving, not your achievements, you're achieving, that is taken away from you. So to be able to take that away is very, very tricky. And the Buddha and Ajahn Chah, all these great sort of teachers, were very smart in actually almost tricking you to let this go. Number one, because it's profound, and we're always very interested in truth and want to experience these things. Curiosity killed the ego. Not the cat. We're curious about these jhanas, we're curious about these bliss, we're curious about the Dhamma. And it's going to sort of, not kill it, but just sort of allow it to fade away. But not only that, human beings are also really interested in pleasure and happiness. And I think really that's one of the major incentives to go on this path of meditation. Because you know the world is a lot of suffering. You don't have to talk about the Four Noble Truths. You know just how difficult and how painful and how disappointing life can be. Life is just so damn frustrating. I gave the orders to these builders of my retreat center months ago to acid the walls, and they still haven't done it. Well, that's life. So, when we get frustrated, we know what this life is. We always want to find something else, some escape, some way of getting some peace and real happiness in life. And throughout our whole life, we search for happiness and meaning in so many areas, you know, in jobs, in achievements at work, in relationships, in doing something for the world. Many, many times we look for peace and freedom. But certainly myself, and I think many of you, sometimes you may have meditated, you may have got an experience in deep meditation. And it's what in Buddhism we call the experience of the taste of freedom. You're not fully free, but you can taste something. And it gives you a taste which you know, well, this is really deep, meaningful, this is the real thing. Well, you know some of my stories, and some of you have similar stories. I was a student, had a steady girlfriend, and I was sleeping with her. I left her over in Gloucester, and I went over to Cambridge to do my first retreat. In a few days, I got an incredibly deep experience, much better than sex. And that didn't really do much for my relationship with my girlfriend, I must admit. But what it did do is say, wow, how can such experience exist? And why hasn't anyone told me about this before? Why don't we have like movies where the boy doesn't meet the girl, but the boy meets the Buddha and just gets blissed out in enlightenment and lives happily ever after? That's the real happy ending. Because very few people actually recognize this. But it gave me like the taste of something really important and profound in this. And it's that which overcame just this attachment to me and doing things and making things happen. Because you realize that real peace lay in the opposite direction. So we do all these little skillful means. First of all, we try and motivate you to let go. And then we actually give you these little tricks to let go. Ways where, in a sense, you really think you're doing something. So it satisfies the sense of you're in control and you're doing the meditation. But really, it's actually letting go of that control. And this is actually why that we teach all these different parts of meditation. And okay, you know, now is the time, you know, 3 days of rest, you can maybe start doing something. With the proviso, actually, you're not doing anything at all. You're actually letting go of the doer by this, what you think you're doing. You can do anapanasati, say. Meditation on the breath. You just watch the breath. And many of you who've read my books, other books, you see there are certain stages of like breath meditation. You know the breath going in, you know the breath going out. And people ask, you know, how do you do that? You know, you focus somewhere, or rather than focus somewhere, I try and keep it as simple as possible. The more simple it is, the more you're letting go. If you make it complicated, you're doing more. However, sometimes people, they just can't do the very simple breath meditation. So you say, okay, just watch the breath and count it. No, breathing in one, breathing out one, breathing in two, breathing out two, breathing in three, breathing out three, in four, in five, out five, in six, in seven, out seven, in eight, in nine, out nine. The next one, in one, out one, in two, out three. Sorry, that's wrong. You see how difficult it is, you know, so when you've got a simple mind to keep counting. Where's my calculator? In one, out one, in two, out two, three, three, four, four, five, five, six, six, seven, seven, up to eight next time. And then in one, out one, in two, out two, in three, out three, four, four, five, five, six, six, now up to seven. Now you see you're getting interested in this because it's something you can do. And you can figure it all out. In one, out one, in two, out two, three, three, four, four, five, five, in six, out six. And then one to five, one to four, in one, out one, in two, out two, in three, out three, in one, out one, in two, out two, and then in one, out one. Now you can see how you all paid attention to that, because you say, yeah, I can figure that one out. It's the sort of thing which I'm used to, giving instructions and having a goal. Yeah, I've finished, I've actually completed one whole cycle, yeah. Give me another badge on my scout uniform. Now, but it's useful for sometimes, because it gives you something to do, something for the sense of self to hang on to, but at the same time you're actually focusing. You're focusing on the breath. Now I used to do that. Very rarely I do it these days, but when I used to do it, sometimes, especially early in the morning, you know, you start, okay, settle in one, out one, in two, out two, and then you find yourself saying, in 16, out 16, in 17, out 16. You completely lost count. You were sort of in la-la land. So at least it tells you, it has a purpose of actually showing you that, yes, you've actually lost your mindfulness. You've forgot the instructions. But when I did this, I always made sure that if I ever had any doubt, even the slightest doubt, where I was, I'd always start back at the beginning again. I was very strict on myself. So only when you've completed at least one cycle, or two cycles, or three cycles at most, then you let it go and just watch the breath. It gave you something to do, but at the same time, you were actually having a lot of letting go. It was a nice way to start. And I've often taught in this meditation, if you are going to do something and do a little bit of controlling, a little bit of work, do it at the very beginning. But when you get to the middle, start really letting go and taking your hands off all the controls. And in the deep meditations, you have to really let go of all controls. It's not so dangerous at the beginning to do a little bit of controlling, such as like counting. Or other times, people do mantras with the breath, just to get them in touch with the breath. And I've already mentioned one mantra, but the main mantra which was used in Thailand, which is still used to this day, and is very, very popular and very successful, when you're breathing in, you recite to yourself, Bud, breathing out, To, Bud Ho, along with the breath. Now imagine if you're like a Thai person who's brought up with Buddhism, and the word Buddha has incredibly powerful meaning. You know, from the time you're very small, your grandmother usually took you to the temple. And so the Buddha was something which is a powerful word. So by having that powerful word together with the breath, for people of, you know, the Buddhist faith in Thailand, that is very easy to focus on. If like a Westerner and you haven't had that sort of that emotional connection with the word Buddha from an early age, it's not so powerful. So you can actually use other mantras. And of course, you know that mantra I mentioned the other day, breathing in, shut, breathing out, up, shut up, shut up. That's a joke mantra, but still it's quite useful. But one of the nicest mantras which we have, which is again, very powerful, it gives you something to do, but also it leads you into some very, very nice insights. And that's, you know, you can use it with your breathing, but very often here we actually use it with the walking. So say do it with the breathing. Breathing in, you recite to yourself, I will die. Breathing out, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. You can do that, especially it's good with walking. Left step, I will die. Right step, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. And what it actually does, those mantras, it focuses you so your mind can't wander off about what you're going to have for dinner or what you're going to do when you leave here. It focuses you in the present moment and it gives you the death meditation. What that really does is it gives you the right perspective. Now, all this past, all this future, all these worries, all these concerns, what's the point? What's the point of worrying about the credit crunch? You know, when you're going to die. When you actually start to focus on, you know, the reality of the ephemeral part of life, it just clears away so much rubbish from your life. There's so much, we always say that if you can live today as if it was your last day on earth, that you knew you were going to die tonight, how would you live? There's a story, a Buddhist story from the commentaries of the Emperor Asoka. The Emperor Asoka, you know, he was a devout Buddhist, but he had this brother who was, you know, he wasn't interested in any type of religion whatsoever. He was just happy he was a brother of the emperor, so he could eat well, sleep well, and enjoy himself. But he also, you know, this brother was, you know, he couldn't actually enjoy himself as much as the emperor. So he was always wondering, when is my brother going to die? Then I can be the emperor, I can be the king, and I can do all this sort of stuff. He had a big ego. And the emperor, Asoka, knew this, and he wanted to try and get his brother interested in Buddhism. So he hatched this plot, you know, with the minister's connivance. The ministers took him into the king's or the emperor's bathroom. And the emperor was actually taking a bath at the time. So he had all his royal robes and royal insignia just on the bench while he was taking a bath. And the ministers said, oh, look at this, the king's having a bath, he just left all his clothes on there. And the minister said to this brother, you know, that one day, you know, you will be the emperor when your elder brother dies. Why didn't you try them on, just for size? Go on. And they said, so the emperor's brother said, I can't do that, you know, that's a crime, that's like usurping the throne. You know, I can't do things like that. They said, come on, no one's looking, we won't tell anybody. And they were pandering to his ego because, yeah, we'd all like to dress up as a king or a queen or somebody important. So they said, okay. And so they put all the clothes on him. And it's a big setup because at that time, as soon as he had the clothes on, the emperor came out of his bath and caught him. He said, what are you doing? Oh, I was only just trying them on. He said, don't you know that that's a crime punishable by death? He said, oh, no, I did, but please forgive me. And the emperor said, look, I've got to be fair. I can't just have one rule for my brother and one rule for everybody else. I'm sorry, there's no way out. You have to be executed. And his poor brother was terrified and fell to the floor and begged for some forgiveness. And all the emperor would do would say, well, look, all I can do, I can't stop the execution, I can delay it for 7 days. And seeing how you want to be the emperor so much, for 7 days, you can enjoy all of the pleasures and benefits of being the emperor. You can go into my harem, you can get the best food you want, the best clothes, anything you want for 7 days. But in 7 days' time, you're going to be executed. And the emperor left. And in 7 days' time, the emperor called his brother to be executed. There was a big executioner there with his axe or whatever it was. And before he was going to execute his brother, he asked his brother, well, for 7 days, did you enjoy yourself? He said, enjoy myself. I couldn't even sleep at night. Oh no, I'm going to be dead in 7 days. I've had a terrible time, the worst 7 days of my life. And there was the emperor said, yes, see, brother, 7 days, 7 months, 7 years, or 17 years. How can you enjoy yourself when you know you're going to die soon? And at that, the brother understood in whole life he'd been indulging himself, thinking that he would never die. And once his the emperor had scared him that, yeah, you're going to die soon, he realized the importance of life. And the emperor smiled and said, brother, this was a setup. Now, I arranged for these clothes to be there, for the ministers to make you dress up. I'm not going to execute you. This was just a lesson for you to learn learn about just how life is short, how you can die any time. And from that point on, the brother became a devout Buddhist as well. And he wasn't so interested in sensory pleasures when he knew just death can come at any time. Which is why I have my favourite saying, never do today what you can put off until tomorrow, because you might die tonight. Now that goes completely against the world, and people actually complain to me, that's just being lazy. No, it's not. If you're going to die tonight, what would you do today? And sometimes we do so much, because we think that we're going to live forever. We can do our meditation tomorrow, or next week, or next year. But really, when we understand that I will die, that's for sure, it makes it much easier to meditate. And all these other things get low priority. And the meditation gets high priority. All this thinking, this worrying, this attaching, this is not so important anymore. Which is why that's a very nice mantra. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. After a while, many of the things you worry about, all these sticks which you pick up, you just don't pick them up anymore. It just don't make any sense. So we have these mantras. It gives you something to do. At the same time, it leads to a sense of letting go. That's why it's very tricky. Because you think you're doing something, but in the end, actually, you're letting go of a lot. So we do this to start being able to focus on something like the breath. There's all sorts of other little tricks which we can do, you know, like trying to have a conversation with the breath. And people say, you're not supposed to have a conversation or commentary. Yes, but that's the best if you have no commentary at all and no thoughts. But how many of you can do that? So understanding the reality, have at least a thought which is about the breath. So sometimes I teach people, when you're breathing in, where is that oxygen coming from? That oxygen is coming from all the trees, all the plants, all that is green outside. Because that actually refurbishes the oxygen in the atmosphere. And when you breathe out your carbon dioxide, that's actually your gift to all the green which is outside. All the bushes, the trees and the flowers, because that's what they need to photosynthesize. So every time you breathe in, it is a gift from the plants and the flowers of this world. And every time you breathe out, that's your gift back to all that's green and natural. So your breath is literally connecting you, you know, with nature. And anyone who's got is a greenie, that really sort of bites. Yeah, so I'm really communing with the trees and with the bushes and the flowers. The oxygen is my link to them, which is true. What it does, it makes the breath a little bit more interesting and fascinating, just for the very beginning. So you are thinking, yes, you are controlling, yes, but in a way which is going to lead to the end of thinking and the end of controlling. Because once you really get into it, you know, you don't need to say that anymore, because the breath becomes beautiful all by itself. And once you get to that stage, I call it the delightful breath or the beautiful breath. I've also called that the springboard, because once you're in that stage, you don't need to have all these props anymore, because the process is like the snowball rolling downhill. It just feeds on itself and gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and the process is on its way. And quite often, well, you can stop it, but if you just let go, it just will go all the way into jhanas and nibbana by itself. But it's just getting to that delightful breath and that beautiful breath. That's the difficult one. So we do have these little props. So another way of looking at it, this anapanasati meditation on the breath, or loving kindness, or letting go, whatever you wish to call it, I developed this simile. It's sort of developed it, but it's an old simile which I explain in a different way from the Buddhist tradition of the thousand petal lotus. And I always make use of this simile in a retreat because it's very helpful on many different levels. Most importantly, it shows you what happens, but it also emphasizes the importance of stillness, of you don't have to move or do anything, just stay still. Because the simile of the lotus is that it closes at night time. And in the morning, when the sun comes up, the lotus opens layer by layer. When one layer is open, so the inner layer, which is a bunched up, a little bud, that layer can now receive the sunshine and can warm up, and that makes that layer open, which reveals the next layer, and that next layer can now receive the sunshine and open up. So it opens up layer by layer by layer. And next about this lotus simile, the outer layer, when it's closed up, if you look at a lotus at night time, the outer layer is leathery, wrinkled, just like some of you. I better be careful who I look at. But it looks really unpromising. If you look at a lotus, you've never seen a lotus before, no way could there be anything beautiful and fragrant inside. Because it's the outermost layer has to take all the wind and all the dust. But even though it looks really unpromising, when that sun comes out and warms that outermost layer, and that opens up, there's something very beautiful and delicate inside. It's the outermost layer of petals. And inside that is an even more fragrant layer. And as you go deeper and deeper and deeper into the lotus, you go closer to the heart, you know, the smell, the fragrance, the scent is more delicious, more beautiful. And also the colours of those innermost petals are more beautiful as well, and they're more delicate. To get to the really lovely stuff in a flower, you've got to go right into the middle of it. So that's the next part of that simile. The outer is very unpromising, but as it opens up, it gets even more beautiful and more profound. But the most important part of that simile of the lotus is to open it up. You don't have to get the leaves and peel them. That destroys the lotus. All you need to do is to shine the beautiful light on that lotus and wait. The light of the sun is mindfulness. And it just has to shine on basically anything for long enough for it to open up and see what's inside. And what's inside, mindfulness shines on that. And after a while, that opens up and you see what's inside. What mindfulness actually does when it's accompanied with stillness, it opens things up. It opens the boxes, the caskets, to see the jewel inside. So in terms of, you know, the breath meditation, sometimes you just sit here, and those of you who haven't invited the breath in, who just, you know, be still and let go and see the breath come into your mind by itself, what actually is happening there, whatever this is, this moment, any old moment, sloth and torpor, restlessness, pain, whatever it is, anything, the most unpromising state, mindfulness just watches that and doesn't move, doesn't do anything, doesn't go anywhere. And soon that opens up. First of all, I like to call it like time opens up. So instead of past and future, you go right into the center of time, which is now. That's what happens. All this past and future business, if you keep still, the past and future goes way over there and you can't see them anymore. All you have is this present moment. And if you go, this present moment, when that opens up, it goes right in the center of the present moment, is the silent mind. Sometimes you can use, like, your intellect to understand that if you're really in the very, very, very present moment, there's no time to say anything. If you say, you know, like bird, you're going into the past. That's just what happened a moment ago. Really, if you're always in the present moment, there's no time to speak. There's no space to say anything. All labels get squashed out of existence. In the very, very center of the present moment, there's always silence there. So as the the lotus opens up, you get this beautiful silent mind where there's no commentary, no words going on. And as you watch this beautiful silence, when that petal, layer of petals of the lotus opens up, lo and behold, you've got your breath there. And the reason you've got your breath there is what really is happening is actually your body is opening up and you're going into the centre of your body, the breathing. Many of you who've heard me talk before may know, or you know, even probably you know this from the Pali more than even the English, but you know what we call the breath meditation, Anapanasati? You all know what sati means, that's mindfulness. Ana means along with, and pana is the breath. But there's also, those of you who are Buddhists, who've got to the temple and received five precepts, you may also recognize the word pana from another context. Panatipata veramanisi karpadang samadhyami. Atipata means to destroy pana. In that context, it means animals. The word for breath is exactly the same as the word for animals, for beings. And that is exactly the same in Latin. You know the word for breath in Latin? Animalis. Animal. Just as in Pali, the same word for breath is a word for animal. Same in Latin. Animal means breath. And so it's almost as if the breath is such an essential part of a being, a central part of it, that when your mind opens up, you usually come to the breath. It's as if all the other parts of the body are disappearing and you go into its essence of breathing. And so that when that lotus petal opens up, you just have the breath. It's the natural phenomena. You don't have to seek it. So it's not a sense of, well, I've done present moment awareness, now I should do silence. Yeah, I've done silence for long enough, now I'll go and watch the breath. These things happen naturally. It's an opening up of the lotus as you go more and more deep within yourself. Now, when you've got the breath in mind, you just wait there. You don't do anything with it. Mindfulness just shines its attention there. So this is where you are really letting go, but at the same time you really think you're focusing, that you've got a goal, a process which you're part of, but really it only works when you're still. Because if you go off looking at the lotus next to you, when the sun's over there, this lotus over here is not receiving any sun and all the petals close up again, which is why you go backwards sometimes in meditation when you try and do something else, or you run off into the future, or you think of something else you're supposed to be doing. But if your mindfulness is shining on where you are, it's natural, it will open up, it has to. It's a process. So you've got this breath, and then that opens up, and we've got what we call the beautiful breath, the delightful breath. Now what that delightful breath is, I've explained this before, and I've used the framework of the Buddha's six senses. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and the mind, knowing. Now, when you just have this breath, when you go into the center of the present moment, that breath, what is actually happening, you're feeling that breath. It's an experience with the body. It's the touch of breath. So, you know, going in, going out, sort of the whole body of the breath means from the very beginning of the in-breath to the end of the in-breath, very beginning of the out-breath to the end of the out-breath, the whole body of this breath process. It's not your physical body. Don't sort of get caught up in that sort of delusion. The Buddha made it very clear. You can show it to you in the Anapanasati Sutta, where the Buddha said, because we call this a meditation on the body because the breath I call a body amongst other bodies. So it means meditating on the breath from the beginning to the end. But that's still the physical sensation of the breath. But then when that disappears, when you go into the center of that, what you get is the mental experience of the breath. Not how the body feels the breath, but as how the mind knows the breath. It's a mental experience. And it changes. That's why that sometimes when people are doing breath meditation, and they're just staying there, sometimes they think the breath has disappeared, and they get lost. Ah, I'm not breathing. But actually they know they are breathing, but they just can't see the breath. What's actually happening is you are still breathing, And often I ask people, when the breath disappears, what are you aware of? What are you aware of then? Instead of looking for what's disappeared, you look what's remaining. And what is remaining is the mental experience of the breath. And after a while you recognize that, ah, that's what it is. It's a similar to an experience where, say, somebody, say Kimanti over there, say Kimanti decides to become a nun. And so she goes to the monastery without telling anybody, shaves her hair and puts on brown robes. And when she comes back home, people say, who's that? Because it takes a while to recognize her when she hasn't got any hair and she's got brown robes on. But afterwards, say, hey, that's you, Kimanti, isn't it? And she smiles and says, that's me. At first, it's difficult to recognize her because she's clothed differently. In the same way that when the breath changes to the mental breath, it's slightly different. It takes a while for you to recognize, oh, yeah, I remember that, that's your breath. But it's how the mind sees it, not the body feels it. And because it's more subtle, it's far more beautiful. Just like you go deeper into the lotus, it becomes more fragrant, more beautiful. And so you get this very beautiful breath. Once you know what's going on, the reason I teach is because then, I know what's happening now. I know what I'm supposed to be doing, which is nothing. I've got the mental breath there. It's just I'm not recognizing it yet. I've just got to stay with it until I get used to it and recognize it and become familiar with it. And it's from that state, the delightful, the beautiful breath, which is just an experience. There's no in, no out now. It's just a very delightful feeling. And from within that, then that opens out. Just like the lotus flower is there, you've got a beautiful, delightful breath, the mental experience of the breath, and it opens up. And that's where you get the nimitta. The nimitta is right inside, it's beautiful light. Because all that light is, that's actually the breath completely disappearing, and this is just the mind. It's your first experience of your citta. So the body and the breath has now disappeared. You've gone so deep inside the body and deep inside the breath, you find out what's in the middle of it. What's in the center? Now your citta, your mind. And that citta becomes very beautiful and very bright, which is why the Buddha kept on calling it the Pabhasara citta, the luminous mind. And that's what you're experiencing. Sometimes when we read these phrases, and I mention this because many sort of teachers talk about the Pabhasara citta, the radiant mind, and this is, you're experiencing it. Those people who had nimittas, especially the strong nimittas, the light is just incredibly radiant and bright. And that's what the Buddha was talking about. People ask me, where did the Buddha talk about the nimitta in the suttas? There's one place, the Pabhasara citta. So this is actually what happens. You're opening up, and of course, people then say, you've got a nimitta, what happens next? Or sometimes they've got a nimitta and it goes back to the breath and it goes to a nimitta again. What's happening there is like the breath petal is open, but it's not fully opened. So you can see inside, but you can also see those petals as well. It's as if the breath is holding the nimitta. And you can see both at the same time. The breath is on the outside, the nimitta is in the middle. So really, all you need to do there is nothing. Just wait and see. And if the energy is right, then sort of the breath will just fade off into the distance on the edges of your screen, and all will be left with a nimitta. If you're not really ready for it yet, you're still sort of doing a bit too much, you're not still enough, then the petals will close again, and you'll just have the breath left. But they'll open again shortly. So you don't have to do anything except just be still and just see what happens, and see what the nature of your mind is ready to do. Your job is to maintain the mindfulness, just like the sun maintains its glare on the lotus, and it just all opens up by itself. When you've got the nimitta, be still, be patient. Patience is an important quality. Many of you know Kanti Paramang Tapo Titika. Patience is the ultimate. Paramang is the same as paramount pictures. The paramount is the peak. It's the same word. Paramang and paramount. So patience is the paramount spiritual practice, said the Buddha. And this is actually, you can see why patience is paramount, because when you're patient you can't be doing things, you can't be interfering with things. So patience is an important part of meditation. was just waiting patiently, being content with what's happening. That means patience, and then things develop because you are patient. But if you try and rush things and just move ahead, then you destroy everything. Just like that simile of my first meditation teacher who came from Bangkok and told me when he was a 5 or 6 year old, his father gave him some seeds to plant in the garden. The first things he'd ever grown in his life. So he put those seeds in the garden, he would water them every day. And after 5 days, he got frustrated. Daddy, nothing's happening. And Daddy had to explain, son, something is happening, but it's under the surface, you can't see it yet. Those seeds have germinated. Little green shoots have come up from them, they've split, and a green shoot for certain is coming up and pushing its way to the surface. Be a bit patient, in a couple of days you'll probably see the first green shoot. So, with that encouragement, this young man was patient, he kept on watering them, and sure enough, 2 or 3 days later, he could see the first little green shoots coming up. It was working. And so he started watering them twice a day. It was okay, that didn't kill them. But when it was only another 5 days, they were only about 2 inches high. And it was at that point he lost his patience. He decided to stretch the plants to make them grow quicker. And of course, he killed every one of them. But he learned a lesson there. You can't stretch nature to make it grow faster than it's programmed to do. I remember him telling that to us meditators. In the same way, you can't stretch your meditation. You can't make it go faster because you've got to leave on Friday. So it just goes according to its own nature, and that's the way it is. So your job is just to be patient. And when you're patient, say with an imitator, it's the patience of stillness. And when it's ready, it opens up. You see what's in the centre of that nimitta, which is what happens to people. They fall inside it, or the nimitta comes up and just envelops them, and it stays. You stay in the centre. Some people get what we call yo-yo jhanas. They go in, they come out again. Because again, they're not still enough, they get a bit too excited. And actually, you don't see that word in the sutta, because they didn't have yo-yos in the time of the Buddha. That's my invention. So this is actually what happens, because you're not still enough. It doesn't matter, just be still. Okay, now the petals opened up and closed again quickly. It doesn't matter, it will open up again if you're patient enough. So your job is to be patient. And the first jhana opens up. And now that is a really incredible petal to actually to see. And that will blow you away. Think that beautiful jhana experience was inside this lotus which looks so wrinkly and dirty and leathery and hard. To think that could be inside of this, it's amazing. But you know that those are in every leathery, wrinkled, old human being, sitting here or not sitting here. It's as if, yeah, there is a jhana inside everyone, inside this very moment. Right now, you're experiencing jhana, as it were, but it's all covered up so you can't see it. So your job is just to uncover everything. The beauty of that description is you don't have to go somewhere else. You don't have to do something else. Don't think that, you know, you haven't got what it takes. You have what it takes. All you need to do is uncover everything. Go in the centre of things. So you're sitting here, this is a hopeless meditation. No, it's not. You're sitting here and just stay with whatever you're experiencing. The most unlikely of starts gives the most amazing of experiences if you leave it alone. And you go right inside. And sometimes for those people who know what to do next, it's a stupid question, but people ask that when they haven't got any idea what jhanas is. Jhanas are, right in the first jhana, you just stay there. You can't do anything else anyway. And maybe it just opens up, the petals open up to the second jhana, which is right inside. The third jhana is inside the second. The fourth is inside the third. The first immaterial is inside the fourth jhana. All these things are one inside the other. And inside the last of the fourth immaterial jhana, which is neither perception nor non-perception. If you can get your head around that, you're deceiving yourself, because you can't get your head around it. You have to experience the thing. So when that opens up, you find the jewel in the heart of the lotus. This is it. The center of you and of all things. That's why they call it the jewel in the heart of the lotus. And you know what that is.
That's Nibbana. There's nothing there. Complete emptiness. Do you believe me? No, you don't. That's why you've got to go and find it for yourself.
So that's why the complete sort of opposite of what you expect. And if you expect emptiness, you're not understanding it. So this is actually how we become enlightened. We open ourselves. What's in the center of all this thing? What's in the middle of this? And that's how you empty it all out. And you notice, as you're emptying everything out, you're going deep inside. All which is on the outside, you're letting go of. You're letting go, I said, of future and past. You're letting go of all your thinking. You're letting go of your body. You're letting go of your will. You're letting go of your mind. Everything is vanishing. That's why it's both spooky, but very profound. And the more you let go, it's a weird thing this, but I think you should be getting the message now. The more you let go, the more happy you are. Happiness is measured by how much has disappeared. The more that's gone, the more free and happy you are. Just like the person walking with a heavy backpack. You see at the airport, some of these travellers, some of the backpacks they wear, or some of the kids going to school. Gee, the amount of books they must have in their back. When I used to go to school, it was just a football on, which I was carrying. Shows you just how I studied. But the amount of weight that must be on their backs. And imagine just you throw a book out, and throw another book out, and another book out, until you've got no books left at all. Then you can dance down the streets. That's just like the simile. When the more you throw away, the lighter you are. And if you want to be fully enlightened, throw everything else. So that's actually just the simile of Anapanasati. All these stages, it's not something, okay, I'm on this stage, now I'm going to go on to the next stage, and then on to the next stage, and then on to something else. It's not like just, you know, doing your grade 12, and then doing your BA, and then your MA, and then your PhD, and then some other sort of qualification. It's not going one after the other. It's going in, and in, and in. You don't go on to the next attainment. You go in to the next attainment. Not onwards, but inwards. And that's an important thing to get your heads around. Because it means if you want to have progress in meditation, you should not discard what you're experiencing now. You should go deeper into it. Not onto something else. Deeper into what you already have. If you go deeper in, and deeper in, and deeper in, you don't have to move at all. You don't have to go to something else. You don't have to throw away your sloth and torpor, or your restlessness, or the stupid ideas, or even your anger. You go deeper into it, the center. In the center of the storm is always the eye of the storm, the silence. Always go in, and in, and in, and in. And there you'll find the freedom. I remember Ananda talking about that. He said that these are the escapes, the okasas from samsara. Just going in. And the next escape is in the middle of this escape hole. In. Never on. So that way, you understand what meditation is all about. You don't have to go anywhere. Meditation is just being more fully where you already were. Deeper into the center of things. Like the simile of the thousand petal lotus. And when I say that, it gets interesting. So yeah, I'll do that. But I never mentioned, to get in there, you have to disappear. Because if I said you have to disappear, no, I don't want to disappear, I don't want to do that. But nevertheless, I trick you into doing it. Just to see what it's like in the center of you. Okay, so, any comments or questions about this morning's talk, about going in? Yeah.
Don't hold the breath. You don't do that. You just, I don't. lesson necessary in order to keep that relaxed, still attitude, right? Just to confirm.
Yeah, just to confirm, the effort you're asking about is the effort to stop doing things, to stop moving, to restrain. To restrain that, you know, wanting to do something else, wanting it to go quicker. It's always the letting go of the controlling, which actually wants to do something. So it's the effort to stop doing. The effort to stop. Open naturally. If you try to open them, you tear them all off.
Keeping with the pedal that we're on.
Yeah.
You
don't try to do anything.
Doesn't matter what we're watching.
All this thing about we are doing the meditation, we are controlling it. We're just actually picking up another heavy branch to weigh us down. So if we've got another burden, something to do, something to make happen. So the effort is actually to see just how we interfere with the process. It's a natural process. The other stimuli which I've been giving in the interviews, and this similarly comes from my own experience of flying all over the world in aircraft. So if you want to go to Nibbana, you can book your ticket on Buddha Air. And as soon as you get on Buddha Air, you get your sort of seat. Oh, it's true, the monks and the nuns, we go the first class, the novices go business class, lay people go economy class, we all get there the same time. So it's no real difference there. So it just appears to be a difference, but no difference. But once you're sitting down in Buddha Air and going to Nibbana, you just sit down. Because there's somebody at the controls over there. The Buddha's actually flying the aircraft. That's why it's called Buddha Air. And the Buddha knows a way to get to Nibbana. You don't have to do anything. You just sit down there. And as you're sitting down, like happens when I go overseas, go to Japan or Thailand or whatever, you sit down and after a few minutes, there's flight attendant comes up to you and says, "Sir, you know, do you want Nimitta?" "Oh yes, please, I'll have a double helping of Nimitta today." So you have a nice Nimitta. And a few minutes later, another flight attendant comes up and says, "Do you want jhana as the second course?" "Oh yeah," and I don't have to do anything. They actually bring it to my seat. I don't need to order it, they just bring it to me. And after I had a nice jhana, they say, "Do you want stream winning? That's a that's a sweet." I said, "Oh yeah, I'll have some of that." And then last of all, they come out with a sort of pièce de resistance, enlightenment. "Here you are, sir. Thank you very much on Buddha Air." So all you need to do, you sit down, relax and enjoy the, not the in-flight service, the insight service. On Buddha Air. And that's actually a pretty good symbol of what happens. You sit there and just all these things come to you. On Buddha Air to be enjoy the insight service. That's a nice simile, which is memorable because it's humorous, but it's also pretty accurate what happens. But if you go sort of hassling the flight attendant, "Come on, look, I've ordered jhanas, it hasn't come yet." Then they're going to arrest you and get you, you know, when you get to the other end, they'll put you in jail for being a pain in the butt. So that's all you need to do. Okay, I think that's enough for this morning. So happy meditating. We have interviews now.